Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Now, if you add up all the books sold by Dan Brown, J.K. Rowling and John Grisham, only then do you approach the amount of books sold by James Patterson. He's written 114 New York Times bestsellers. Patterson is a publishing machine, a statement that might have an element of literal truth to it, because Patterson doesn't write all his own books. Dr. James O'Sullivan is part of a team that's done some research into this. James, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Now, Patterson is quite upfront about this, about the way he operates.
So when we set about doing this research, it was a colleague of mine, Simon Fuller, came to me and suggested this study. And I was expecting to go into this thinking that we were going to have a nice gotcha moment, but there isn't a gotcha moment, in the sense that he is actually quite transparent about his process, in the sense that he finds junior authors, typically people who want to, you know, have a platform to launch their own careers, and he works with them in the sense that he outlines the plot structure. They start to fill in that structure, they bring him drafts, and then he gives feedback or redrafts, as he says he does sometimes, and they work from there as they build the story that essentially has got his brand on it.
Right, and it is his brand, because that book invariably will appear with James Patterson in very large letters.
Very large letters, yes.
And that's why people are buying it.
Yes.
So I suppose your study was to try and ascertain how much actual James Patterson or another author is in each individual work. How do you go about doing that?
So we wanted to go about finding out how much of the actual writing he does in his in this process. So we use a technique called stylometry. So I work in a field that we call digital humanities, which is essentially the use of technology and computation to do typical humanities and arts research. I work in, my background is in computer science and literary studies, so I work in what we call digital literary studies. And what stylometry does is it basically brings quantitative methods to the analysis of authorial style. And what you can do doing that is you can take a whole range of approaches to essentially what is authorship attribution. This method emerged out of, you know, sort of the juicy authorship attribution questions, things like, you know, Shakespeare. There was a scholar, Matt Jocks, did a famous study where he looked at the authorship of the Book of Mormon. But what we do basically is we form what's called an authorial signature of authors independently. So we look at Patterson's solo authored works and his collaborator solo authored works. And once we form that authorial signature, we then apply that to the collaborative text to see whose fingerprint is most dominant. Now, in all of the Patterson co-author text, the co-author, the junior writer, is the dominant fingerprint, which would suggest statistically that they do all of the actual writing.
Yeah. Now, forming that fingerprint, is that like an algorithm
it's very, very simple statistics. So basically what we do is we look for what's called an authorial variant. Now, there's various different types of variants, there's various different types of invariants you can use. An invariant is just something that's consistent across a range of texts. You could look at the length of a word, the length of a sentence. We typically use the most frequent words. Now, the most frequent words are typically function words, so basically the words that you use to structure a sentence, words like the, boring words. I like to describe this field as a field where we take a lot of, you know, literary significance from boring words. So basically, once you have a list of, say, an author's 100 most frequent words, you can use that to form an impression of how that author writes. The reason why function words are useful is because they're frequent enough to be to form a statistically robust sample. Everybody's choosing from the same pool of function words when you're writing the same language in the same, you know, period and other certain literary contexts. Once you have that authorial fingerprint, then you can cluster authors based on their style.
Right, okay. So I suppose another way of putting that is that all authors will have their tics or their ways of using words or favourite words they like to use.
I mean, the thing about function words is that we tend to use them subconsciously. So whenever you're writing, say you're writing an email to someone, you're probably not thinking about, when you're thinking of word choice, you're thinking about the content words, the significant words. You're not thinking about, I've used the too much in the sentence. It's the same when you're reading, you know. I mean, the last time you're reading a novel, I'm sure you're not thinking about the amount of, you know, times that an author uses the word the. Authors use these words, they use function words very subconsciously, and empirical studies have shown that if you count these up, you can get a very accurate indicator of of how an author writes, and we use that then to do attribution studies.
Mm. So how many Patterson novels did you look at this way?
So the way that the study works is, so basically because we need to counter samples, so we can only look at authors, co-authors who actually went on to have their own career and had solo novels that allowed us to form a fingerprint of their writing. So what we did first was we basically form Patterson's authorial fingerprint by looking at the novels that he wrote by himself. We do the same with his co-authors, and then we combine those to look at all of the collaborative novels. So you can't actually look at all his novels because you don't have a sample for the co-authors, for all of the co-authors. But we did find in some instances, for example, he wrote a series with Andrew Gross, where Andrew Gross is attributed from the second novel in the series on, but we did find Andrew Gross's fingerprint in the first novel in that series, but that's attributed to Patterson solely. That was an interesting finding.
Yeah, that is interesting, yeah. And is it able to divine, if you like, a proportion? You know, is it 70-30 or... In the co-author novels, is it essentially written by the co-author?
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially written by the co-author. I mean, what we do is this is hard to kind of represent on radio, but what we call a rolling delta analysis, which basically breaks the novel up into windows, and it shows you basically how dominant a particular fingerprint is over the course of the novel. Mm. So what you would typically see in a co-authored novel is basically someone's fingerprint would be dominant in particular sections, which would basically indicate, you know, you wrote the beginning and I wrote the end type thing. Whereas in Patterson's novel, it's just the junior author is dominant throughout.
Right. But presumably there's some sort of system in place there where Patterson has devised the plot and is perhaps overseeing it.
Well, that's what he says. He does say that he's all about plot, he outlines the plot and they do the writing. Now, he does say that sometimes he redrafts, other times he just gives feedback. I would suggest that he just gives feedback, that he doesn't really do a lot of redrafting. If he does, then he doesn't have a very distinct authorial fingerprint, which is the first study I've seen where that is the case. But of course, I mean, it does raise questions. His approach to the kind of the way that he's commodified collaboration does raise questions around how we think of authors. I mean, the notion of style, an author's privileging style, I mean, that's very much, you know, kind of a modern contemporary phenomenon. I mean, the novel, when it first emerged, was very much about popular entertainment. It wasn't about style. It was the higher modernists. It was people like Joyce who started privileged style. I mean, it's academics and scholars like me that privilege style. But for a lot of people, you know, story is about story. And Patterson is really just bringing it back to that in many respects. He's just saying that, look, if you see my name on a novel, it's not going to be, you know, anything. It's not aspiring to any literary greatness. It basically means that it's going to be a good story. It's going to be a James Patterson story. And, you know, when I went into this, you know, I did really want the gotcha moment. But as I read more of his interviews and read more about his process, because he comes from a kind of a background in marketing and he's been described as the first brand managed author. You really do start to think about, you know, kind of the tension between, you know, story and plot and style and expression and, you know, what makes an art, what makes a novel versus art, what makes an author versus an artist.
Yeah.
So it was interesting from that respect as well. It kind of challenged my own assumptions of what an author is.
Yeah, but there's a lot of other authors who would contend that style should be invisible. That Elmore Leonard, for instance, hates style. He says if it reads like writing, take it out.
Well, I mean, if you look at, I mean, all of the famous contemporary novels. So if you look at the novels people are reading now, people are reading things like Harry Potter, Twilight, you know, The Hunger Games. This is what the world is reading now. And, you know, they're all about story.
Hmm. Yeah, so there's not anything necessarily wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with the stories
emanating from James Patterson.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. I mean, he is the world's best-selling author, so it becomes a question of, well, how much writing should, you know, I mean, the way that we phrase it is, you know, the world's best-selling author isn't necessarily a writer. And that, you know, raises a lot of questions around not just authorship, but the publishing industry as a whole and the literary industry as a whole. And
yeah, because I suppose you could argue that even authors, even very serious authors, often have to work with editors quite intensively. And there's a degree of collaboration there. The author mightn't want to admit it, but it's there.
Well, that's the thing. There have been studies that have looked at sort of editorial influences and whatnot. And typically they are limited. I mean, there's a whole range of things that can influence a stylometric analysis, but generally the author's style does emerge. I mean, when you do an analysis like this, when you do what we call a cluster analysis, you typically get what you'd expect. I mean, what I always tell students when I'm teaching this is if you get something that doesn't cluster correctly, you either have a very nice discovery, but the likelihood is you have a mistake.
Yeah. You know? The thing is, what's interesting about this is why don't more people do this?
Well, digital humanities is becoming a sort of a prominent field now, and has done over the last, you know, this isn't very new. People have been doing this for 20, 30 years. And of course, people were doing this kind of quantitative approaches to style before we had computers. It's just we can do it very, very quickly and efficiently now. I suppose that there is a sort of a barrier to entry in terms of the technical expertise that's required, and not everyone who might have the literary expertise will also have the technical expertise, or they might be suspicious of the literary or the technical side of things. I mean, one of the things that people who criticise this field often say is that we're reducing literature to data, which, I mean, nobody's saying here that literature is data. What we're doing is we're saying that literature is made up, I mean, whatever literature is, it's you know, it's a system of various different elements, characteristics and traits, and some of those elements can be isolated and quantified, and they can tell us something about literature. I mean, the drive here is still, I mean, you use this evidence for the basis of literary interpretation. I mean, you don't, the quantitative evidence, what the computer tells you doesn't drive your analysis. It doesn't drive your literary criticism. It just supports it. It's just a new type of evidence.
Does it prove, though, that writers are kind of prisoners of their own style to a degree? Because one would imagine that if you're a master writer, you can write book A in one way and book B, because it requires it in a completely different way. Much the same actress can be different people.
Yeah, I mean, that's very true. It's very rare you see a writer who can fool the machine. Now, of course, we're taking a very particular, we're going at it with a very particular definition of style and what style is, which is a whole different argument.
Yeah.
It's rare that you see, I mean, where that becomes interesting is when you see if you were to isolate the dialogue in a text and look at how different writers write gender. Would there be a separation between the male and female characters and whatnot? And typically there's not. The machine just lumps them all in as the one voice, the one authorial voice. There are instances of writers who can successfully fool the machine. Oftentimes then, though, that could be just because there's a genre difference, for example. I mean, if you take someone like, Ernest Hemingway, who would have written a lot of fiction and non-fiction, obviously there would be a separation between the fiction and non-fiction because of, you know, the different genres, very different type of writing. But in cases like sometimes, Charlotte Bronte, for example, writes her dialogue would in some instances fool the machine. She would write gender quite differently.
Really?
Yeah. And that's a skill that I would say that 99% of the writers just don't have.
Yeah. She did write under her name, but it's interesting in writers from that era, perhaps particularly female writers who might have had to pretend that they were men.
Yeah.
Might have been aware of that then.
I mean, this is a wonderful... These methods are perfectly suited to authorship attribution. So, I mean, I've always been waiting for that juicy, you know, who wrote this question to come up, but it hasn't presented itself yet.
One of these days it will. James, thanks a million for coming into us today.
That's
Dr. James O'Sullivan there, Research Associate at the University of Sheffield.
Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank? Having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas